Well, I would like to start. This is April 15th, 2024 of the Common Era, and the time is 1735 hours Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green with you again today for our study of the Crucible. We're beginning also the book of Ezra today, phenomenally. And we're reading chapter 5 of Zechariah, Jehovah willing. I want to talk about so many things. In the Crucible article, part 2, we're in chapter 10, and we've been looking at paragraph 3 with this table 4, the last king of which is, for the Assyrians, Tiglath-Pileser III. We haven't altered his date according to the conventional chronology, nor have we altered the date of Nabonassar, the Babylonian king, or the king who began to rule in Babylon in that year. Now, Tiglath-Pileser is the famous biblical king also, whose date for year 1 is 744 BCE, here given in table 4. The problem is, well, there are many problems prior to him. That's what we've been discussing, the 46-year discrepancy. But we mentioned in today's discussion, I want to talk about just a few things before we move into some other discussion. But there are so many things I want to talk about. It's exciting. I'm eager to do it, but our time is always limited. I rarely get to talk about exactly what I want to talk about. But it's Tiglath-Pileser III, 744. Oh, yes, right. And then Shalmaneser succeeded him in 722 BCE, so he doesn't appear in the table. But he's used to calculate the average for 9 generations in this calculation down here. The first one called before, which we rejected because it was a calculation which ignored the 46 years that we found to be required in order to give the proper average. The first version here for all of these dates needed to be shifted up by 46 years, except for the 727, which was, I'm sorry, Shalmaneser V, his year one is 727. It was in his year 5 or 6 that he besieged Samaria. That was the year I was thinking of, 722. But 727 was his year 1, 727 BCE. So here we've got the average. All these other years will change except for the 727. So when we did the after calculation, the averages didn't change for the first period of time because both of those were shifted by 46. So the average was 27. But when we lower the 1225 for Ashurdan the First to 1215, which we did also later, we got an average of 26 years, which is still acceptable for firstborn sons. And then in the second calculation from Ashurdan the Second to Shalmaneser the Fifth, which ends in 727, having raised the first of those dates to 981, we got an average of 28.2 years per generation, which is also acceptable for firstborn sons, the average generation for which is typically and almost reliably, without exception, as an average, between 26 to 28 years. So, and there, the only exceptions to that are in the times prior to Moses, when men lived average lifetimes or lifespans exceeding the time of Moses and afterwards. So, Ashurdan the First, we've changed from 1225 to 1215 here in this summary at the bottom of this section of the commentary. Shalmaneser ruled from 727 to 722, and at least that long, maybe even longer, but his reign was usurped by the last part of his reign was usurped by his successor, Sargon II. Okay. Anyway, we're not discussing Sargon right here. But when we come down to this 46-year discrepancy in the date of the reign of, we haven't discussed him, Ashurnasirpal the Second in the table, he should be, there he is, 930. He's You can find him here. The Shalmaneser I was talking about, who was 905, he's Shalmaneser the third, not the fifth. But Ashurnasirpal the second is 930 BCE in our chronology, in the table there too, which is our chronology. We presented it. Now, wait a minute. Have we lowered these other kings if we've lowered? No, we haven't. You see, we've revised the length of reign for Ashurdan the first. So even though, so we've modified his year one from 1225 to 1215, but the table has the corrected value, 1215. So, yeah, there's no worry in the table at all. Everything is correct to our chronology, corrected. So, there we go. But the 46 years that we found was a necessary adjustment in our table, as we mentioned here. It was only possible of those 46 to account for or resolve 26 of those years initially. And then, I mean, there was no problem resolving those, but then there was a problem because of what we believe it was caused by, which was the years of Tukulti-Ninurta the first. And there's a lot of confusion in a lot of the accounts that we have to consider, but because there are correlations between different kingdoms. For example, when Tukulti-Ninurta became the governor, and I haven't looked at this recently, so I don't know all the details, but when he became governor of Babylon, we were able to figure that out as being a 15-year period from 1233, with him as governor, down to 1217, the end of the reign of Enlil-Kudurri-User, coincidental to the time of the accession of the Kassite king, who felled him. Enlil-Kudurri-User having been an Assyrian king. I haven't even looked at that today. So there's so many things to look at. I'm looking at a lot of things every day here. But if we go, let's go back to Tukulti-Ninurta, right? Here we go. Enlil-Kudurri-User, 1222. Right. Okay. So, and he ruled until about 1217. About 5 years, it's according to that. Enlil-Kudurri-User, 1222 BCE in our chronology. And Tukulti-Ninurta was the governor from 1233 of Babylon, and he died in 1217. And we give him still his 37 years of rule from 1254 to 1217, but his sons, who I believe are these kings who ruled in the interim here, 1232 and 1228 and 1222, Enlil-Kudurri-User being one of those names, that they are during the reign or during the lifetime of Tukulti-Ninurta. So when he was governor of Babylon, perhaps he had his sons ruling. It makes perfect sense. In Assyria. And they were Ashurnasirpal and Ashurnirari III, as well as Enlil-Kudurri-User, with the first one having begun in 1232, Ashurnasirpal, which is about the same exact year, within 1 year of the 1233 that we said Tukulti-Ninurta began to govern Babylon. So, yeah, it's we didn't find any problem when we really worked it out, but nobody else has the understanding that we were able to obtain here. Our chronology is quite singular, and it works so much better, in fact, than the other chronologies, which if you try to get a chronology from conventional chronology, I mean, if I'd found one that worked in the conventional world, I would have just adopted it, but there wasn't one. I had to create it out of the facts. So, there we go. Confusion that seems to prevail at the time is then neatly resolved and is followed by the reign of Adad-Shumna-User. We dare not speculate about when his rule began and ended, although he may not have ruled at Babylon except briefly. We have him ruling at Babylon for less than 1 year. In Assyria, King Ashurbanipal I we take as ruling from nearly 1215 BCE, and that is within the variant 36-year reign, which has been a possible allocation according to the Nasuhi king list. Thus, the discrepancy of 46 years may be resolved also in keeping with a revised 26 years per generation for Ashurdan I to Ashurdan II, who is 981 now, and a familiar 28 years per generation obtained for the descent of Ashurdan II to Shalmaneser V. So we still have within the range 26 to 28 years per generation for firstborn sons, which is what it should be and what we know it should be for an average over 9 generations or longer. The reign of Kassite King Melchishapak II at Babylon city seat must now be raised 36 years to 1222 BCE, right? That's the next paragraph. To align that date with that of Pharaoh Ramesses III, whose time of rule began in 1223 BCE, and we have determined that, even in the crucible, as being his year one, and it's got all the lunar alignments. It's perfectly aligned to the lunar cycles reckoned relative to the total solar eclipse of 1340 BCE, which is required by witnesses local to Hattusa and Troy, a midday event singled out with a strong preference for it over 5 other candidates. And that's almost certainly according to Peter Huber. April 13th, for example, is one of the other alternatives in the year 1308 BCE in the Julian calendar, April 13th. As corresponding best, in our case, the 1340 BCE eclipse, to all of the evidence known regarding a solar omen which is believed to have occurred near year 10 of the Hittite king Mursili II. It was a solar omen that he talked about in his writings. That's what we have. Well, I would sure like to cover some other information. One thing that I found to be fascinating was when we take, in the article, where is it now? I had it in one of these articles here. I think it's this one. Where did we add these up? The Sussex? No, that's not it. Oh, wait a minute. Okay, I want to find this. This is important. Is it in the Babylon article? Okay. Oh, I think it might have been. Let me just look it up in terms of Manetho. We're going to go back. Shift. Let's go back. No, it's not him. It's not there. Wait a minute. It's this one, I think. That's what I think. Come on. Okay, it's 177 is the number I'm looking for. Isn't it? Yeah, there it is. 177. Here it is. Okay. Yeah, from 1375 Akhenaten. Okay, which we can... We've given that as his year one in our revised chronology. After the crucible, we arrived at 1375, which is 3 years higher than the 1372 that we had for Akhenaten. But look at this incredible thing. When we look at the Book of Sothis, we can take the years of the father of Akhenaten, given here on page 241 of Waddell, which is called Manetho, his book, in the Book of Sothis, part of his book. It's pseudo Manetho, the Book of Sothis. It's not really thought to be Manetho, but the Book of Sothis is a record of the Egyptian pharaohs. We have the father of Akhenaten, 34 years, his predecessor, and all the predecessors back to Amos. When you add them up from this, directly from this book by Waddell, we get the answer 1552 for year one of Amos, which is incredible, because that's precisely the year we have for Amos the first. How could that have happened by accident? So there's a brilliant confirmation of our chronology right there. Not to mention many others, which we don't have time for right now, but hopefully we will get to them. We've got to go and begin our study of Ezra, before which I would like to now look at our daily proverb, little children. And I've lost track of where we are, but I can check here. I believe I can just quickly find out. We had 11 and 12. That was from the 14th. Today's the 15th, right? Yeah. 11 and 12. Okay, yeah. Proverbs 15, verses 13 and 14. A heart that is joyful will have a good face, and pain in the heart of a sad one a place. A heart is discerning when seeking to know, but fools in a word have their folly in tow. Proverbs 15, 13, and 14, the Ward Green version from 2004. The book of Ezra. Now, Ezra, in the commentary of Adam Clark, is a very long dissertation for the book of Ezra. And I think most of it we have to discard, almost, or at least consider as not as important, because he talks about the oral tradition of the Jews, and we know that Jesus said something against the oral tradition of the Jews very strongly. But I could speak about my own oral tradition that my ancestors gave me, which was that the pen is mightier than the sword. And the pen being the written word, the sword quite clearly being connected with the oral tradition, as we can see from one particular biblical quote from Hosea chapter 7, verse 16. And they proceeded to return not to anything higher. They had become like a loose bow. By the sword their princes will fall because of the denunciation of their tongue. By the sword they will fall because of the denunciation of their tongue. So the sword is connected with the tongue, and the pen, we know, is connected with the written word. So we have the pen mightier than the sword in my oral tradition that I have been given. And we know that Jesus denounced the oral tradition of the Pharisees and scribes, because they had used their oral tradition as an excuse to depart from the word of God. Now, Ezra chapter 1. He was a wonderful scribe, a brilliant scribe, and he didn't live at the time necessarily of which he writes here. He also wrote the book of Chronicles, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, that is, and the book of Ezra. But he's writing about this time, which we just read about at the end of 2 Chronicles, chapter 36. And it repeats itself in the first chapter of Ezra, for the first part. And in the first year of Cyrus, the king of Persia, that Yahweh's word from the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished, Yahweh roused the spirit of Cyrus, the king of Persia, so that he caused a cry to pass through all his realm, and also in writing, saying, "This is what Cyrus, the king of Persia, has said. All the kingdoms of the earth Jehovah, the God of the heavens, has given me, and he himself has commissioned me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah." Cyrus mentioned Jehovah by name. He was a believer, obviously, from that. "Whoever there is among you of all his people, may his God prove to be with him. So let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and rebuild the house of Jehovah, the God of Israel. He is the true God, which was in Jerusalem." The house was in Jerusalem. "As for anyone that is left from all the places where he is residing as an alien, let the men of his place assist him with silver and with gold and with goods and with domestic animals, along with the voluntary offering for the house of the true God, which was in Jerusalem. Then the heads of the fathers of Judah and of Benjamin and the priests and the Levites rose up, even everyone whose spirit the true God had roused, to go up and rebuild the house of Yahweh, which was in Jerusalem. As for all those round about them, they strengthen their hands with utensils of silver, with gold, with goods, and with domestic animals, and with choice things, besides all that which was voluntarily offered. Also King Cyrus himself brought forth the utensils of the house of Yahweh, which Nebuchadnezzar had brought out from Jerusalem and then put in the house of his God. We know there were many, many things in the temple, right? The table of the showbread, the lampstands. None of those existed because they'd been Jerusalem had been invaded many times. We see what was remaining of the utensils here. And Cyrus, the king of Persia, proceeded to bring them forth under the control of Mithridath, the treasurer, and to number them out to Sheshbazzar, the chieftain of Judah. Now these are the numbers of them. 30 basket-shaped vessels of gold, 1,000 basket-shaped vessels of silver, 29 replacement vessels, 30 small bowls of gold, 410 small secondary bowls of silver, 1,000 other utensils. All the utensils of gold and of silver were 5,400. 5,400 utensils. You can imagine what glory the temple of Jehovah had from the time of Solomon down until this time, which was the first temple, it was called. If it had 5,000 in total utensils, which were just the smaller utensils, and everything Sheshbazzar brought up along with the bringing up of the exiled people out of Babylon to Jerusalem, Sheshbazzar, who is Zerubbabel, I think we have to say that was his Babylonian name, who became the governor of at that time of Judah after the Jews returned to Jerusalem. Now, a lot of research is done on all of these things. The remarkable thing here is that Ezra didn't live at this time. He lived later at the time of Nehemiah in the 7th year of Artaxerxes, as we're going to see during the reading of this book of Ezra. But also one thing I want to mention, after they returned, it says here in chapter 3, when the 7th month arrived, they were in their cities. Now which year, if it was in the first year of Cyrus, which we just read in chapter 1, and at the end of 2 Chronicles in chapter 36, the first year of Cyrus, which we know is 538, because all of the witnesses regarding this, who even, you know, all of the witnesses of the true God agree that 539 was the year that Cyrus conquered Babylon. So his year 1 couldn't be later than 538, after 539. 538 would be the latest for his year one. So the 7th month mentioned here is no earlier, probably either. It's probably no earlier than 538, but it probably isn't as late as 537, because that, if it were, that would mean it would have taken them 18 months or more, assuming the proclamation of the year 538 was early in the springtime of that year. Then the 7th month would be a year and a half later if it was in the year 537, because the first month was springtime for the Babylonians as well as for the Israelites. So their religious first month, anyway, was the first Nisan, which was the first month, and the vernal equinox was near the time of the first of Nisan. That's how they had their calendar. So, do we really believe it would take them 18 months after the decree of Cyrus to return home? It seems, although it might be possible, it also seems possible and maybe more likely that they returned in the year 538, which would be in fulfillment of the 70 years from 608 to 538. Those 70 years having been referred to by Jeremiah as the time during which Israel would serve the nations in the Septuagint version of Jeremiah chapter 25, verse 11. So, that's quite significant that in the first year of Cyrus, they returned in the seventh month, sometime after. But in the first year, the declaration made by Cyrus, having initiated that return of the Jews to Jerusalem, and in chapter 3, verse 1 of Ezra, the seventh month of their arrival, is likely 538. I just wanted to mention that. That's a very probable time period. Do we have time to read Zechariah chapter 5? I think we do. It's a fairly short chapter. Then I raised my eyes again and saw, and look, a flying scroll. So he said to me, "What are you seeing?" In turn I said, "I am seeing a flying scroll, the length of which is 20 cubits and the breadth of which is 10 cubits. Then he said to me, "This is the curse that is going forth over the surface of all the earth, because everyone that is stealing according to it on this side has gone free of punishment, and everyone making a sworn oath according to it on that side has gone free of punishment." There's a scroll, the written word, the scroll. Remarkable. And Ezra was a scribe. "I have caused it to go forth," as you know, we know Zechariah lived at the time of this same time that Ezra writes about, when Cyrus allowed the Jews to return to Jerusalem, and this is sometime after that, in the year 520 instead of the year 538, 18 years after what we just read about as Cyrus year 1 in our chronologies. 18 years later is when Zechariah is writing this, not long after, but he's writing about a scroll. And we know Ezra was a scribe, so it's quite interesting, isn't it, how that coincides without any effort on our part? And you notice the scroll was written on both sides, just like we were talking about regarding the scroll that had been written in the time of Amenhotep III, which was used as, because it was written on the other side, it was used as evidence regarding the time that corresponded to the time when the Hyksos were expelled from Egypt, which we know was during the lifetime of Moses, also in about the year 1533 BC, which is about 40 years, when Moses was about 40 years old. And in fact, that scroll could have been written on by Moses himself, because he was of the right age. He'd been born and raised by the Pharaoh of that time in the northern kingdom, Pharaoh Apophis. So all of those things we've talked about, "I've caused it to go forth," is the utterance of Jehovah of armies, verse 4. "And it must enter into the house of the thief and into the house of the one making a sworn oath in my name falsely. And it must lodge in the midst of his house and exterminate it and its timbers and its stones." Bad thing to make a sworn oath in the name of the true God falsely. Verse 5, "Then the angel who was speaking with me went forth and said to me, 'Raise your eyes, please, and see what this is that is going forth.' So I said, 'What is it?' In turn he said, 'This is the ephah measure that is going forth.' And he went on to say, 'This is their aspect in all the earth. And look, the circular lid of lead was lifted up.'" And this is what a certain woman, this is a certain woman. This is a certain woman. Look at this. It just says, "This is a certain woman sitting in the midst of the ephah." That's interesting, an interesting way of writing it. "So he said, 'This is wickedness.' And he proceeded to throw her back into the midst of the ephah, after which he threw the lead weight upon its mouth. Then I raised my eyes and saw, and here there were two women coming forth, and wind was in their wings, and they had wings like the wings of the stork, and they gradually raised the ephah up between the earth and the heavens. So I said to the angel who was speaking with me, 'Where are they taking the ephah?' In turn he said to me, 'In order to build for her a house in the land of Shinar.' and it must be firmly established, and she must be deposited there upon her proper place. That concludes Zechariah chapter 5. Regarding the stork, in the Insight book under stork, notice what it says here about the wings of the stork. It's phenomenal when we look at this reference. The primary feathers of the stork are fingered out in flight so that slots are formed at the ends of the wings, thereby controlling the airflow over the top of the wings and improving their lifting power. Storks were, in this case, describing the wings of these two women who were raising this lead lid of the ephah. Along with the ephah, they raised it off the ground. They must have had powerful wings, and here we see that the stork does have powerful wings. Also, in the reference for building her a house in the land of Shinar, this wicked woman called Wickedness, in regard to that, we see from the Watchtower, October 2017, in the article entitled Visions of Zechariah, How They Affect You, paragraph 17, it says, to the Israelites of Zechariah's day, Shinar would be a fitting place for wickedness to be confined. Zechariah and his fellow Jews could confirm that Babylon was a place of wickedness in their day, having grown up amid the filthy and idolatrous ways of this city. They had to fight every day to resist the spirit of that pagan world. What a relief this vision must have brought them, a guarantee that Jehovah would keep pure worship clean. That is just about it for the study here today. But, I mean, we were looking at so many interesting things. I want to show you something else. Right, the Crucible article was followed by Before Chronology, which did revise it somewhat and included this wonderful chart at the end of chapter 2, paragraph 11, which showed, is that the end of it? Oh, here it is. Is this correct? I think we're, no, that's not. It's the end of chapter 1, I'm sorry, not chapter 2. The end of chapter 1, I believe it is, where we had this chart. This is Babylon? Oh, I'm in the wrong article. Babylon, here it is, yeah. I was looking at Wild Road there. That was the Wild Road article we were looking at. That's where we saw that 177 years was in the Wild Road article. Right? Yeah. I think so. Here it is here. That was from the Wild Road article, by the way. And what paragraph? 1-8, I think. We've just run out of time, so it's April 15th, 2024. We'll get back to this tomorrow, hopefully, and the time is 18:08 hours Eastern Daylight Time. I've enjoyed this. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. And in my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie, saying bye for now.